Hello, and welcome to episode 80 of Thaisi Books, news and views about Thaisi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Butt. Thank you for tuning in. In today's Thaisi Craft Chat, we have Devi Lusker discussing her new novel, Circa, and writing in the second person, how fiction can show a possible path out of grief, embracing how journalism informs her fiction and poetry, using the pendulum method to finish a book, and what's changed or not for older women writers of colour, and much more. Devi Lusker is the author of The Atlas of Reds and Blues, winner of the 7th Annual Crook's Corner Book Prize 2020 for Best Debut Novel Set in the South, winner of the 2020 Asian Pacific American Award for Literature, and finalist for the Northern California Book Awards. Her second novel, Circa, was published May 3rd by Mariner Books. And her third novel, Midnight at the War, will be published by Mariner in early 2024. She holds degrees from Columbia University, University of Illinois, and UNC Chapel Hill. A native of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, she now lives in California with her family. Circa follows a young Indian American woman who, in the wake of tragedy, must navigate her family's expectations as she grapples with a complicated love and loss. On the cusp of her 18th birthday, Hira and her best friends, siblings Marie and Marco, tease the fun out of life in Raleigh, North Carolina, with acts of rebellion and delinquency. They paint the town's water towers with red anarchy symbols and hang out at the local bus station to pickpocket money for their great escape to New York. But no matter how much Hira defies her strict upbringing, she always avoids any real danger. Until one devastating night changes everything. In its wake, Marco reinvents himself as Crash and spends his days womanizing and burning through a string of jobs. And meanwhile, Hero's dream to go to college in New York is suddenly upended. Over the years, Hero's and Crash's paths cross and recross on a journey of dreams, desires, jealousies, and betrayals. Heart-wrenching, darkly funny, and buoyed by gorgeous prose, Circa is at once an irresistible love story and a portrait of a young woman torn between duty and her own survival, between obligation and freedom. On a personal note, what I've always enjoyed about Devi's fiction is how she brings both her journalism and her poetry to bear on the writing and storytelling. And while this book is different from her first novel, it's still signature Lusker in those respects. And I so appreciated this wide-ranging conversation, as you're about to hear, with Devi about various aspects of writing craft and the publishing world for older women writers of color. Here's Devi Lusker now. Hi, Devi, and welcome to Thaisi Books. Congratulations on the new novel, Circa.
Hi, Jenny. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. No, I always look forward to conversation with you because, you know, you were so generous and kind when my book came out. And it's always just interesting to talk to another, you know, Thaisi woman writer who also came out later in life. And we'll talk about that in terms of, you know, the book and everything. So let me start with
you know, I ask this question, not to every writer, but I do ask with some writers. And the question I want to start with is, when did you know this was the story that you wanted to write with Circa? I'm always curious about that moment of commitment, because a novel is a multi-year undertaking, right? Absolutely. And so I'm always curious about, when did you know, okay, I have a novel now. I've got a full-fledged thing I'm going to commit myself to.
Wow. Okay. So I guess I'll answer that in a two-part answer. I started the original story Circa in 1995. I was writing pretty much an autobiographical story at that point, with one of the main characters being my friend who I dedicated the book to. She was diagnosed with cancer, and then she passed away. And so I started to write the book while she was still alive, and it was really different. I was in my 20s. A lot of the electricity of what I found to be the electricity of the story was set in the past. It was like flashback. And then she passed away, and I set the book aside. I tried over the years a couple times to get back into it. And like I tried first person and third person, and I tried different things, and it didn't quite work. And then I set it aside to do other things. And then, as you know, everything was pretty much taken from me. The bulk of my work was taken from me in 2010. And although the circumstances surrounding the raid and all of that stuff, a judge dismissed all of that in 2016. But, you know, it's now 2022, and we have yet to get the apology or our belongings returned. So when Atlas, my first book was, when the Atlas of Reds and Blues was picked up, then I remembered the story. And although I didn't have it anymore, the bulk of it, what I did remember was my main character and the character, one of the friends that's actually a main character in the book as well. And I remembered that I really loved it, and I was no longer interested in the truth of our relationship or the more autobiographical stuff. And I was a lot older. And so I was like, you know, I'm just gonna write something else, but I'm gonna keep my characters. I'm gonna keep my two characters that I really love, and I'm just gonna start over. And by this time, my classmate's book, so my classmate was Julie Otsuka at Columbia, and she had written The Buddha in the Attic, which was first person plural. Right. And so I was like, oh, I want to do that. I want to do first person plural. And I tried really hard, and I couldn't. And I had already tried first person and third person limited and omniscient, and none of that worked. But then I stumbled on second person, and that's when I knew that I had the book, because the voice just came really fast. And that was like late 2018, early 2019. And then it took me a couple of years. But once I stumbled on second person, that was when I knew I had a book.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it's interesting how when you find the voice or the point of view, and suddenly the whole book changes. I say that because it just happened for me. I'm not writing in second person, but I just changed the character, the point of view character for the mm-hmm. story. And suddenly the whole thing just opened up for me, you know, what I'd been struggling with. So I totally hear you on that sometimes it can take just that little shift. But yeah, you know, you mentioned about how, and you've mentioned this before in other interviews about losing everything that you had on your right. laptop, you know, and that's, I mean, horrible. I just think I can't imagine. But I'm so glad that, I mean, you still, the characters must have meant so much to you, right? That they stayed with you. So I want to talk about that too, because, you know, this is a slim novel, but you've packed in so much with Hira's life, you know, from her teenage years to the marriage, and then, you know, with her family life, her love life. You've got a little bit of the career that kind of doesn't happen. You've got the coming of age, coping with the loss and the grief, the whole cultural baggage of being Indian American. And what I was curious was, what interests you about exploring a life in this way? Is it that, you know, you see the patterns in a person's life, you're able to show them, or the journey, the evolution?
So I think what I was really interested in by doing this was that I wanted to give the slice, you know, before she got old. I had written, when I started writing this book way back when, I was closer to Hira's age, but Hira was also older. But what I found was the really interesting stuff in the story was happening when she was a little bit younger. And I didn't want to tell another flashback story. I was really interested now in using present tense. And then once again, when I got to the you, you know, and I got to second person, I was like, oh, well, this actually makes it quite immediate, right? And I really was interested in that, like how to span those few years with that kind of immediacy. I was really interested in that. Yeah. And so, you know, I just made a decision that, you know, when I got to the second time around, I was writing Circa, you know, I was much older and I was closer to the mom's age than I was to Hera's age. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, I actually have this gift by being able to see it from both sides now that I'm older and also a parent. And so I felt like that really helped me balance it out.
In that 6 years, and I think, you know, I think I completely lost track of just the amount of time just because there was so much happening.
Right.
Because, you know, once you have the Marie situation, and I'll try not to give away too much, but you have the Marie thing happen, and then you've got the mother's illness, you've got the Murray, you know, the DeMarco thing. I mean, there's so much happening. And my goodness, as you were talking then, I was like, wow, that all happened in 6 years. I zoned that part out, the 6 year part, because I was so focused on so much going on. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was because I was maybe thinking, where are the similarities with Atlas? But you're absolutely right, because with Atlas, you had the mother looking back at her whole life, whereas here you've got a span of 6 years and it is in the present tense. Yeah, that's totally different. So, you know, you mentioned that you wanted to explore in the present tense. And, you know, one thing as I was reading, you know, we do have, I felt like the real love story wasn't necessarily Hira and Marco or Crash, but it really was Hira and Marie in a way. Because, you know, I felt like there were times when I was thinking that, because, for example, when she plans to name her unborn child Maitri, because it has Marie in it, right? And then you've got the novel closing with this heartbreaking scene where she thinks she sees Marie, and then, you know, I won't give away too much, but I feel like the reason for that is sometimes the teenage friendships, and you talked about earlier about how one of the prompts for this, when you first started to write it, was a friendship you had. But they are the ones that affect or shape us the most, even though we may not have the appropriate level of self-awareness, obviously, at the time. And so I'm curious about, as you were exploring, again, you know, the older you, writing about the teenage Hira and this friendship that she has, what was maybe just some of the epiphanies you had about teenage friendships as you were writing? Because again, you're coming at it as a much older woman, as you said. And I was thinking that as I was reading, looking at it, looking back onto my own teenage friendships, you know? So what were some of the things that you thought of differently now writing it as an older writer than when you first began?
That's such a good question. You know, I, you know, my little funny story about that is that, you know, as I was when the first time I was starting to write this, you know, I was very young. And so then I was writing it definitely from Hira's point of view. And it was more, you know, there was a lot more defiance and, you know, us against them and pitfalls that I find now to be, you know, pretty stereotyped, you know. And so then when I went back, you know, I was like, oh, you know, I have a chance here to let it all go and just really focus on just telling a really good story and not try and anchor it to real life events. And also, because I'm older and I'm also identifying more with the parents, you know, I have a chance to make this just, you know, as balanced as I can, right? And not make it us against them, but make it, you know, more like, you know, I've had poetry teachers tell me over the years, you know, you don't want to write confessional work, you know, that stuff, while it's beautiful, and it can be beautiful, especially, you know, it's different when you're writing nonfiction, obviously, but in fiction, you don't want to make it confessional. What you really want to do is try and take the kernels and the seeds and make a myth, right? Make a story that's just a really good story that's got seeds and truth, but has suspense and anticipation and to make it relatable, right? And I really hung on to that. When I was writing this book, I was like, you know, I just let go of the real life situation of her illness and her death and just made a story that really celebrates the friendship. And I think when you're young, right, everything is, you're so, you know, you're impressionable, right? And when you have a setback when you're young, you know, you recover and it kind of colors your lens, right, with which the way you see your world. And I was trying to explore that as well.
Yeah, no, I definitely thought that you did balance you didn't show us this rebellious daughter having to live with these stereotypes, because, you know, they're people too. The parents are people too. They have their own issues.
Right.
So I thought, yeah, I thought that was balanced for sure. You know, what I also thought about was, you know, Hera grieving Marie over the years through her own ups and downs. And you've talked, obviously, just now and then before as well, elsewhere, about losing a friend in different circumstances. And I have a question about when we explore this kind of loss and grief through fiction, as you've just said, and rather than writing from our wounds, you know, maybe writing from our scars, if you like, where we're not, you know, we're not writing with all the anger and that emotion, but, you know, as you say, mythologizing it or fictionalizing it. But whether as readers or writers, when we explore this kind of loss and grief through fiction, do you think it helps us cope better? And I ask this because I'm sort of on the fence about this, to be honest. I'm on the fence about whether fiction can do that necessarily. But I'm curious because I haven't necessarily written about grief and loss the way you have. So I was curious.
I feel like, you know, I feel like when you read a good story, when you read a story that kind of shows you a path, even if you don't take it personally, you know, if you don't assume the path personally, it's uplifting, right? It gives you hope. It makes you reconsider how things are going, and maybe, hey, I can borrow from this. One of the things I realized, you know, because I was writing this book during a pandemic, is, you know, a lot of young people have lost a lot, right? You know, I mean, everyone has lost something through the pandemic, but young people have really lost a lot. They've lost the socialization, right, of being in school with their peer set. They've lost the friendships because they've been cooped up in their houses. They've lost people, right? And then once again, these are like pretty heavy losses when you're young, and that just shapes who you're going to be when you get a little bit older. And I found that, you know, I really hope the young people read this book, because I feel like there, it does show a way out, right? It shows a path. If nothing else, you know, maybe it'll start a conversation about what it means to work through your grief, and work through your losses. And here's one person's, you know, fictional way of doing it, but it's one way, right? And just like with Atlas, I felt like it started conversations about racism and misogyny. And I feel like this book hopefully will start conversations about the patriarchy, right? And that we are all firmly living in it still. And, you know, I set this book in the 80s, right? Mostly because I really did not want to write a book that had all the modern contraptions that isolate us further. I wanted to really be centered in an era where we all still wrote and had landlines and received letters. And that was just a different time and a different way of communication. And I think that if nothing else, you know, that's just it's just a book that hopefully will just start conversations about, you know, hard things that we are all still working through as we enter.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I liked that the book was, you know, there are no cell phones. I liked when you had the parents going off into the bedroom and talking on the landline. And, you know, 80s, that's when I grew up too. And I remember that, you know, when people would close the door and go and have a conversation. I think to your point, you know, a lot of young people have lost friends or family members in the pandemic, and this whole, they've had to deal with grief and loss that, I know people personally in my own extended family who are coping with this. So yeah, it's tough. So, you know, let's come to that second person voice, because, you know, I know you've mentioned it a couple times, and you've mentioned how you know your classmate Julie Otsuka was one of the inspirations. Now, you know, I've written short stories in this, and that's not easy in the second person voice. You've written an entire novel. So I guess my question is, talk a bit about maybe just one or two of the challenges and the pleasures of working, you know, for an entire novel with this voice. And what did you feel you could do with this voice that you couldn't do with the first person and the third person?
The second person is just wonderful because I feel like it does double duty here. It's reflexive, right? So it is the I, right? But it's also, it is forcing a collapse between the narrator and the reader. So now the you makes the reader come into the room and sit right next to the narrator as things are happening. And I feel like by collapsing the distance, like it's doing this really good job of, you know, making us really experience all the things that Hira goes through. And so there's no misunderstanding or misinterpretation of what's happening. You're right there. And I really loved that. And so, you know, as I was stumbling around a couple of years ago, and I had written a few of the early chapters in You, and I was just really taken. Yeah, there are some days, you know, where you slip out of it, right? And then you're like, oops, you know, I'm back to she, right? Or I. And then, but once I actually got into it, and I was, you know, doing my edits and I was finishing the book, the unintended consequence is that the next thing that I wrote was also in second person. It's like, once I started, I couldn't stop for a while. I was like, I'm just going to write in second person from now on. Right. And so that was really funny actually. And it took me a little while to get out of it. But it was true that the next couple of things I wrote, like whether it was an essay or a poem, it was all second person. And I was like, okay, now I have to make it stop. And I don't quite know how to do that, but it did eventually work itself out. You know, I don't know whether you ever read Vikram Seth's really wonderful novel, The Golden Gate.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So it is written in sonnet, right? Yes. In rhyming English sonnet. So I read that book. I loved it so much. I started doing it, you know, and then I started doing it. And I was like, oh gosh, right. You know, now I'm writing in 14 rhyming couplets. And it was so wonderful for a few minutes. And then I was like, no, I really have to stop because I can't do this forever. So I think I was experiencing a little bit of that with you. And but I love you. And I was just so happy it worked out. But I also loved how it just shortened the distance, you know?
Did that. I mean, I know there were parts where also because of your language being as poetic as it is, plus with the there were parts where I, as a reader, and I think that's what you intended, I was feeling uncomfortable. I felt like, this is heartbreaking. This is painful. But that's what you want the reader to experience. And so I think,
right.
But what are, it, could you maybe give us maybe one or two challenges? Let's say somebody out there is thinking of doing an entire novel like this. Mm-hmm. What are maybe one or two things you would tell them to watch out for with second person?
Sure. Well, you know, you have to kind of walk a little tightrope here because sometimes it's just reflexive, right? And so you want to kind of watch out because I think it only really works if you're just able to make the prose experiential, right? So for example, you know, I've had teachers over the years tell me, you know, good writing is often visual, right? Right. Because most artists and writers, you know, really rely heavily on the eyes. But if you want to elevate the writing, you want to make sure you have at least two or more senses in each page, on each page, in each paragraph.
Right.
And so the two that I really like watched out for and made sure I had were hearing, so ambient noise, and smell, because every room has a smell, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was just, that was my challenge, was to make sure that to make it experiential, I just not only did I have to make sure the you was working, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also to make sure that I was using like ambient noise and smell on each page so that people were really there. Right.
Yeah.
They were really there. Yeah. And so that's all that is really. I mean, this isn't hard in the sense that this is practice. Like mm-hmm. I felt like as I kept practicing, it got easier. When I first started to write the book in second person, I was like, I don't know. I don't know if this is actually the correct, but the voice came really fast. And so I was like, well, I think it is, but now I'm going to have to really watch out so that I'm not falling into these little quicksand, you know, traps. Mm-hmm. And so, so I just had to be careful, but I also just kept having to practice. And so now I've practiced for a few years and now I need to unpractice.
Yeah, you need to kind of lock it up again and say,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So talking about that, what you just talked about, you know, the experiential, immersive experience, I think part of that is also, in addition to what you said, in addition to having engaging the senses, in your case, I find your language is poetic. It is lyrical because, yes, you are a poet as well. And I don't mean it's too lush, but it is poetic enough that when I'm reading certain sentences, I'll pause and think, oh, that was beautiful, you know? And you've been a journalist, right? And you're also a poet. I felt like both of these came together in this book because I felt, you know, you're giving us this near history, right? Because you're back in the 80s, you're kind of writing about a time. It's not about our present contemporary time. So you've given us a little bit of that near historical perspective. Your language has that poetry to it. And so I have two or three questions. In fact, even you have certain short sections or fragments that read almost like standalone prose poems, right? You don't actually have, I felt those were beautiful too. So I have maybe two or three questions here related to the language and how you came about some of that.
Sure. So
my first is, you know, of course, the novel form is the most capacious when you compare it to poetry or journalism, because poetry is a very distilled form, you know, minimal words, maximum meaning. Journalism, you know, you're giving the facts, and yes, you may still write in an immersive way, but the container itself isn't as capacious as a novel might be. So my first question to you is, where do you feel you are most in your element of these three forms?
Oh, that's so great. That's a great question. So I will tell you a little story. Hopefully this will answer your question. I went to Vona a few years ago as a student. One of our breakout sessions, like in the afternoon, was run by Tananarive Due, who writes speculative fiction. And she used to be a reporter and editor at the Miami Herald. And I know her personally because we have a very dear friend in common that I went to school with. And so I remember that at that time I was really struggling with how my journalism, and I used a different I word, I used the word infect. I said, my journalism background is infecting my prose and my fiction and my poetry. And Tananarive looked at me for a few minutes and then she was like, no, you're using the wrong I word. Your journalism is informing your prose. And she's like, you're marrying two things and that's just who you are as a writer, so don't fight it, just embrace it. And it is true that, you know, I've been a poet for a really long time, and for a long time I was also a reporter. And so now that's, you know, I've been told so many times over so many years to keep it short, right? And so I finally think that the lesson has sunk in, and this is just how I write now. I'm just drawing from all the writing experience, all the different experience that I had, and it's just coming together on the page. And I can't help this way, you know, this is just the way I write now.
No, but I think it makes for a much, and I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, but I had a conversation with Bohini Vara recently. Her book just came out, and she's also a journalist who has written fiction. I mean, yes, her, you know, she has an MFA in fiction, but you know, she's also a journalist and she's practicing, she's still doing journalism,
right?
And I feel like it brings a certain, you know, a certain set of layers and depth to texture to the writing because of how you trained yourself or been trained to write, you know, as a journalist. And in your case as a poet as well. So I mean, I think you know, your instructor at Vona, Tananarive, was right. It is an influence, it's not an infection,
right?
And I mean, I think, for example, Wainey's book wouldn't be the book that it was, although that it is, I shouldn't say was, that it is, without her journalism background. I think the book becomes what it is, and I felt similarly with your book, because I read these two back to back and I felt, oh, here's two journalists or ex-journalists, whatever, you know, and I thought that's interesting. They're very different books, of course, but still I felt that in both cases, your journalism background has informed your writing, and that I think is important. The other question I have related to the poetic fragments that almost, some of them, not all of them, but some of them almost stand alone. And so as I was reading, I was wondering, did you write the book chronologically, or do you write scenes and situations as they come to you? And I ask this because I'm a chronological writer, so it fascinates me when I hear that most writers necessarily aren't. So I was curious about that because I felt that some pieces could stand alone as poems.
Oh, that's such an interesting question. So I am actually really rotten at writing the middle of anything. So I actually did the pendulum method, which is I wrote the beginning. I wrote what I thought was the end. It changed, but I wrote. And then I went back. I wrote what would be the new beginning based on what was the end. And then I ran back and I wrote what I thought would be the new ending. And I went back and forth like this for about a year until I got to the middle. And I was like, oh, I have nowhere else to go. And then when I did the second pass, that's when I did go in order of what I had. And that's when I realized, oh, this is actually my ending way over here. And so then I went back and did my pendulum again. I'm like, okay, so then if that's my ending, then this is where I need to start. And let me just make sure all the parts bounce back and forth correctly. And until I get back to the middle, which changed a little bit, right? And then, yeah, I'm just rotten at the middle, so.
No, but you know what's interesting? I've now talked to quite a few writers, obviously, in the last 2+ years. And every time I ask this question, it's always a different answer. There are no two similar answers, right. which tells you right there that there is no one way of writing a book. Every book, the story may end up being similar, but I'm telling you, every book is written differently. And, you know, in your case, it was the pendulum method and you had to go back and forth, and everybody writes it differently. So I'm always fascinated because right there, you know, one of the things that Matt Bell talks about is, you know, people, we can analyze novels and we can look at novels, but the actual process of writing a novel is something that's unique to everybody, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm in a longstanding writing group. I have a writing partner, the same writing partner for decades, right? And mm-hmm. So I see her doing different things too, right? And so, and then, you know, with the book I'm writing right now, you know, I started off writing it chronologically. That was a first, right? And now I'm like, oh no, I've got to go back to the way I do things,
right?
Because I'm reinventing the wheel and I can't do that. I just have to go back because I'm once again going to be stuck in the middle. So I just have to do what I normally do because otherwise I'm not going to be done. Right. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, fascinating. Yeah. Now, you know, I want to switch gears because you and I, we met on Twitter, right? In 2018. Right. I remember I was tweeting about all those, you know, lists of writers under 30 and writers under 40. And I remember I think you had a book coming out in 2019, right? Mm-hmm. And yes. And so that's how we connected. And it was about, we talked about older debut writers and women writers of color. You've now got two novels out. You've got a third one coming next year. Is that right?
2024, early 2024.
Okay, yeah, early 2024. And I did want to talk a little bit about that later, but so my question to you is, do you think in 2022 now, it's unbelievable how many years have passed now since that, you know, but do you think in 2022, things are better in the publishing world in terms of visibility for older women writers of color like us?
I don't think much has changed, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we're, you know, more visible on Twitter, but Twitter is not real. And I think publishing is still at 86% white and male, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think the needle has moved much. But all that to say that I really think that we now see each other more, right? Even though we're in a pandemic, we're like, oh, you know, we have more community. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's going to help, right? As we hold open the door for the new people who come after us. And as we, you know, hold each other's work up and shout, right?
Right.
There's more of a shouting in unison, you know, and holding each other's work up and saying, look, read this, right? So I think that part's great, but, you know, Twitter isn't real. So I don't think that, you know, the needle has moved much.
I think what happens is, you know, we look at social media, we live in our bubble, you know, we know other writers and we think, oh yeah, you know, but I live in a world outside of that as well, as you do it too, I'm sure. And when I'm socializing, especially within our Desi community, you know, let's say here in Dallas, and I'll ask, and you know, they'll ask me, what do you do? And I say, I'm a writer. Oh, and then they'll think hard about the last book they've read, which is not mine. And then they'll say, oh yeah, Jhumpa Lahiri.
Right. Or,
right. So, you know, it's still very much, or Salman Rushdie, or, you know.
Right.
Because it's the big names that won the awards and that lodged in their head.
And right.
So, and
I have to say, the one thing that has happened, I feel like, is that, you know, if you take the big media with a capital M, as a whole, right? So, you know, I feel like Crazy Rich Asians and Pachinko and, you know, stories like that, making it on to the big screen, things that were books that were now in the big screen, that has helped, right? Because I think now there is more exposure, right? I think I see a lot more, like one of the most wonderful series I've come across in the past 6 months is We Are Lady Parts. Have you heard of that? It's so good. It is so good. It's set in England. It's written by Nita Manzoor. It's so good. It's funny. It talks about these Muslim girls, some of whom are Orthodox, some of whom are in a punk band in London, right? And it's so good. And I'm definitely a cult follower there, right? But I'm like, okay, great. You know, there's more, we need more of this, right?
Yes.
And I mean, I love, you know, I loved Minari a couple of years ago. Yeah. And I was like, okay, we just need more of this. It's just, and you know, Mindy Kaling is doing groundbreaking work, right? Which is really amazing. And I just feel like, you know, we're all inching along and we just got to keep, you know, shouting out for each other and building community, and it will happen. It's just not happened at the pace with which I would like, you know.
I mean, I've been doing this thing with Desi Books since April 2020, you know, and right. I think it is better. But you're right that it's not there yet. I mean, even when I think our writers are getting heard, it's still the younger narratives, you know, so it's okay. Writers of color are getting more visibility, but it's still the younger lot. It's the older woman writer is still kind of invisible, but that's kind of, I think, across all colors. It's not just, so we're still not there yet.
We're not there yet, but I do feel very hopeful, you know, that we're getting there, you know, like I feel like, you know, the more we can just be there for each other.
Yes.
And, you know, keep holding up each other's books.
Yes.
Then, you know.
Yeah.
And I think
university presses are really helping.
Certainly. Oh, absolutely. I just feel like we're just getting more chances, right? Yeah. I just want, you know, we're not going to change the conversation, unfortunately, until we get a lot more people at the table. People who look like us, but also don't look like us, right?
Right.
And And I think we're getting there, but it's just so slow.
Yeah. Slow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I'll be honest. I had recently, and I'm saying when I say recently, it's within the last 6 months, I was talking to a very good literary agent who loved the current book that I'm working on. And she said, it's historical fiction, first of all. So that's not always a big seller anyways. But she was like, unfortunately, she says, it's just that I wish you were writing something contemporary and it had, I hate to just be honest with you, but I'm going to be honest with you, it had some younger folks in it, because a lot of folks at the editors, you know, the publisher, big publishing houses, they're younger women. And she says there's a lot more women of color, but they are younger and they want to see themselves represented. So that's, they want to see themselves in the books. And so, yes, there are more books by writers of color and they are featuring more, you know, protagonists of color, but they're still younger characters as opposed to older. And I'm like, well, everyone's going to get older someday.
You know? Right. That's right. And, you know, we have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and I just don't want us to get into that, fall into that quicksand trap of, you know, writing for an particular audience.
Yeah.
I still remember when Kate DiCamillo wrote The Tale of Despero, and she won all these awards, and she went on PBS, and she, you know, somebody asked her, you know, well, you know, did you have this audience in mind, and, you know, what's your age range here? And she just gave them the blankest stare, and she goes, no, I just wrote my story. Right. What you guys do with it is your business. I just wrote my story, and I figured my audience would come. And she was right. And I really held on to that when I was writing Hera again, right? When she was younger now, right? And people were like, oh, this is YA. And I'm like, well, there's nothing wrong with that, but no, it isn't. And if you need some help with that, I can point you to like White Oleander by Janet Fitch, which has a young person and it's still an adult book, right? And I can point you to Assigned Reading, which, you know, every high school student in America reads To Kill a Mockingbird, right? And Jem and Scout are quite young.
Yes.
Right. And so I'm like, no, it isn't YA, though there's nothing wrong with that. But no, it is just a young person, right, you know, in an adult book, and that's fine. And and you know, it doesn't matter. It's whatever the author would like it to be.
Yeah.
And we have the right to do that. And
Right. Yeah, well, anyways, yeah, positive, but we have ways to go. Okay, so what's next? I know you've got this new novel that was announced, which I'm very excited about, because I think you've got these journalist characters, and could you maybe just talk a little bit about that for listeners?
Sure. It's called Midnight at the War, and my protagonist is a, you know, brown-skinned reporter who has been sent back to cover a conflict for the second time. This one is set post 9/11, and but also, like, you know, it is based on the news of the time, but it is also just based on the idea of cable news being at its infancy, so print media was still at its height. And you know, and it talks about maternal ambivalence and morality. And it also talks about, you know, the people who get to tell the news and the people who get to tell the truth, and just how skewed it is, right? Because often the people covering the news are not the same, do not have the same upbringing or understanding as the people that they're covering. And so there is a gap, right?
Yes,
and and we see that more and more these days, right?
Yeah.
And I really wanted to explore a book about, you know, who gets to tell the truth and what does
that, you know, that's interesting you say that and you make that distinction, because it reminds me of this book last year. It was nonfiction, Against White Feminism by Rafia Zakaria. And she wrote about these white women journalists going to you know, Middle East and Far East, and I mean, well-intentioned going there to report, as you say, the news, but with their biases and their blinkers and, you know, what that does. So it's kind of interesting, but yeah, I'm looking forward. I think in the announcement, it said something, it mentioned Christiane Amanpour, and I thought, oh, nice, interesting.
Right. You know, I loved her when I was first getting into journalism and, you know, I was growing up. I remember her and Sylvia Pajoli. I remember them because they would go to places where I'm sure their editor did not assign them to go. You know, I remember Christiane Amanpour single-handedly brought the war in Bosnia to the American, you know, TV, you know, and to the American, you know, family, because she was the only one there for a while, right? And she just kept reporting. And I was like, good for you, because otherwise we would not know. And I think she laid the groundwork, which is why, for example, you know, we are getting the coverage that the Ukrainian conflict deserves now, right? Yeah. Yeah. And it deserves that conflict. That conflict deserves that kind of coverage. Yeah. I just wish that, for example, when we were at the height of the Syrian conflict, we got this coverage, right? Because I don't think we know.
Right.
And it really goes back to who's assigning the stories.
Yes.
Who's getting to tell the truth.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, we see it even now, like even just in the New York Times, when somebody writes what might seem like an innocuous little story about pop culture, but it ends up being something else because of who's writing it. Right.
So right. We get to write. We're so lucky. We live in America. We get to write whatever we want. You know, I think as writers, though, we have to write. We have a little responsibility there. We have to write with dignity and compassion. So we get to write whatever we want, all the hard stuff, whatever we'd like, but with dignity and compassion. And so then we are then gonna, if we do that, then we're avoiding stereotypes and tropes and then, you know, there shouldn't be a problem. I just think that it's often really easy if you're not, if something is vilified, you know, then it's easy to fall into those quicksand traps, right?
Well, with that, I know we're almost at the top of the hour, so I'll close with my final question, which is, what's your favorite Desi book and why? And favorite is a tough word, so it could be recent.
Of all time?
Favorite. Yeah, well, exactly. It could be tough to say favorite of all time. It could be your recent favorite, something you read this year, maybe even. So, yeah. Anything you'd like to highlight or spotlight even? Yeah.
Sure. Well, I'll answer it a couple different ways, I guess. You know, I really loved, my favorite of all time, you know, is a book of poetry by Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni. It's Leaving Yuba City. I think that's a really strong book of poetry that we should all be reading. I loved Bhanu Kapil's The Vertical Interrogation of Strangers, also a really strong book of poems. Then this year I have read Whereabouts by Jhumpa Lahiri. Yes. I really love that book. It's beautiful. I really love her work. You know, it is really beautiful. I think the book that over the years I've recommended, two books over and over again, written by Desi writers. One is my classmate's book. Kiran Desai was my classmate in grad school, and she wrote The Inheritance of Loss. And I love that book. And I recommend that book a lot. And also Arundhati Roy's, you know, The God of Small Things.
That book is the one that I would say gets picked the most often, even now.
Because it's just such a like sweeping, amazing story. Yeah, you know, it's just so groundbreaking. And, you know, right now I just bought The Immortal King Rao, and that is next on my next on my list to read. I'm so excited to read it. I'm looking forward to, you know, taking a few minutes to read that book because
That book is, there's a lot crammed into the book, and I had a great time talking with Wai Niwara as well about it.
Oh, so great. I'm looking forward to all of that. And so, you know, and I loved Anjali's book, books, you know, I interviewed her, Anjali and Jetty, a few months ago when Southbound and Departed Earth came, and, you know, her essays are just stellar, right? Southbound is such a great book. And you know, and I have Departed Earth right here in my stack of books that I love, you know, and thought she did a great job with that book.
I interviewed her too. So yeah, we both, did that. Yeah, so great, great selections right there. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Davey. And I absolutely loved your second novel, and I look forward to the third one. And just wish you all the very best with the journey, Circa's journey. And I'm looking forward to the next one.
Thank you so much, Jenny. It was such a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to episode 80 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bart. Thank you for tuning in. Today's Desi Craft Chat was with Davey Lusker discussing her new novel, Circa, and about writing in the second person, how fiction can show a possible path out of grief, embracing how journalism informs her fiction and poetry, using the pendulum method to finish a book, and what's changed, or not, for older women writers of color, and much more. Episode 81 will be up shortly. Follow on Twitter at Desi Books, Instagram at Desi.books, Facebook at DesiBooksFB. Tag the accounts if you have requests or suggestions. And please go to the website if you'd like to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. That's DesiBooks.co. And please share this interview via social media so we can keep raising the tide of Desi literature. Stay healthy, keep reading, and write well.